normal. Talks like an animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animal. Talking animal. Talking animal.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and before I go any further, I want to offer my huge thanks to all those who pledged the support of Talking Animals before or during last Wednesday's Fun Drive show. Owing to an array of donations and on-air help from Bev Capshaw and the Fabulous Flea, we reached our goal. I'm enormously grateful. Thanks again for all your help. And again, if you didn't get a chance to donate, there's still an opportunity. You can go to WMNF.org and still pledge right there. So, love to hear from you if you haven't had a chance thus far. Meanwhile, my guest today is Dr. Crystal Heath, a noted shelter veterinarian. Over the years, Dr. Heath has carved a distinctive path in the realm of ethical animal care and advocacy, and in voicing the tenets that ethos has occasionally ruffled some feathers, as it were, amidst the more traditional sector of veterinary medicine. Moreover, she serves as executive director of Our Honor, a nonprofit supporting veterinary professionals and promoting ethical practices. She's a key figure in advancing humane treatment of all species. Not coincidentally, perhaps, Dr. Heath is a vegan veterinarian and will be a speaker at the 2025 Tampa Bay Veg Fest happening Saturday, November 8th, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Perry Harbor Senior Park. The talk Dr. Heath is slated to deliver at Veg Fest at 1 p.m. is entitled Bridging the Divide Between Activists and Veterinarians. She's recalled in interviews that her childhood included participation in her 4-H club, including a stint as vice president, raising goats, chickens, and horses, eventually learning that some of her goats would be slaughtered, as would some of the animals raised by her friends. With what we already know about her thus far, it's probably unsurprising that Dr. Heath now sits on the board of Leaders for Ethics, Animals, and the Planet, or LEAP, considered the humane alternative to 4-H. We'll explore some of this, seek a sneak preview of her Veg Fest talk, and more when I speak with Dr. Crystal Heath in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Meanwhile, coming up later on today's show, I'll speak with Lee Berry, Executive Director of Education at Tampa Bay Watch Discovery Center, which is presenting an event this Saturday, October 18th, called Boo on the Bay, described as a Halloween-themed event where science meets seasonal fun. We'll have more details when Lee Berry joins us later in today's show. Right now, though, let's discuss the intersection of veterinary medicine and advocating humane treatment of all species, among other topics, with Dr. Crystal Heath, who's expertly navigated that territory. And again, we'll speak on the topic at the Tampa Bay Veg Fest coming up November 8th. So, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Dr. Crystal Heath to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Dr. Heath.
Good morning. How's it going?
Going really well. Thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thanks for having me.
For sure. So, in some ways, your childhood figures prominently into your current narrative. So more than customary, I'd kind of like to hear about where you grew up.
Yeah, I grew up in rural Northern California. So East Bay, far east, at the base of a mountain called Mount Diablo. And yeah, we had lots of farmed animals, horses. I grew up drinking unpasteurized goat's milk. Cow's milk tasted quite weird. And it wasn't until kindergarten when, you know, they kind of forced cow's milk upon us that my parents were like, well, I guess we have to get them used to drinking cow's milk now. And slowly got accustomed to drinking that before eventually, you know, not drinking cow's milk at all eventually.
Sure. So, what were your kind of chief interests, though, growing up there like that?
I loved mostly being around animals, taking care of my animals, riding horses, competed a lot in hunter jumper, dressage, three-day eventing, that sort of thing. But yeah, eventually now I don't ride horses anymore at all. So
I guess there was a part of that, too, that ties into your time in 4-H.
Yeah, I was the vice president of my 4-H club. I was part of the Morgan Territory 4-H club. And I actually did a lot of photography in 4-H. We also spun wool, but raised goats and chickens for 4-H and participated in the horse and the dog projects. But even back then, I have a twin sister too, and we got our hands on some PETA material early on. And my sister was the first one to go to 4-H camp with a meat is murder lunchbox. And there
that must have caused quite a stir.
Not really. I mean, there were a lot. There were some vegans in 4-H, but it was like back in the day, if you loved animals, like 4-H was really the only thing that you had. And it was kind of weird how we became socialized to using animals in this way. And it became a decision point for me of like, oh, do I want to do the pig project? Could I, you know, slaughter a pig? Could I sell my pig that I raised to the, you know, auction? And it kind of like, you go through this thing of like, am I not mature because I don't think that I want to sell my beloved pig to the auction? Am I not, you know, becoming an adult because I object to that? Instead of it mostly being framed as like, we don't need to betray our conscience and our friends that way.
So it sounds like in some ways, before you actually got into 4-H, you kind of knew, like, depending on what kind of undertaking you signed up for, that there would be an end point that would involve slaughtering the animals that you raised? Or did you only find out after you were already kind of midway into it, kind of?
I think with our goats, so we raised dairy goats, and it wasn't until midway into it that we realized if we bred our goats and then we had boy goats instead of girl goats, that the boys would have to be sold to slaughter. And so that's when I just decided not to breed my goats after that. But I knew that the pigs were raised for auction and the steers and, you know, the sheep as well. So, and I was in the wool spinning project and kind of debated getting my own sheep so I could shear them and have wool and then, you know, learning that, you know, so there are some neat sheep that are sold to auction and I didn't want to participate in that.
So how old are you, Dr. Heath, when you sort of this awareness kind of dawned on you about what was involved about the goats and then the pigs, et cetera, and the sheep as well?
Oh, I think I was like 12 or 13 years old. But I first became aware of the issues around animal-based protein production, I think when I was around 10. And that's when me and my twin sister first tried to become vegetarian. And my parents made it very hard. I think they were very worried that we would not be healthy. We would not grow to be healthy because we are already very small, skinny children. Mm. So I think they were very worried about that. And then it really wasn't until I was 17, kind of moved out of my parents' house that I started becoming more vegetarian, and then gradually over the years getting my act together and becoming vegan.
So when you say moved out, does that mean going off to college or?
I moved out to go train horses because
wow.
I thought I wanted to be a horse trainer, and moved down to Carmel with a dressage judge. And but also I was doing a lot of house sitting, and I house sat for some people who volunteered with PETA, and they had a micro sanctuary and they were vegan. And so I got to see what they ate, what was in their pantry. And then it started to make more sense to me. But yeah, ultimately I ended up having a lot of problems with the horse industry and realizing that I could not do it in a way that aligned with my values. I did rescue horses from the track, from, you know, off the track thoroughbreds, and train them for a while. But after I had two horses all through college and growing up, and both horses ended up passing away from, they were older and had a lot of issues, and then one colicked and died. And that's when I decided to sort of end my horse riding career a few years ago. And now I've just worked for horse protection.
So to what extent did the horse experience and or the 4-H experience kind of shape your outlook? It sounds like it was kind of some formative things that almost by coincidence on a couple different things about PETA sort of encircled you at a very young age, where there was information around and people that you were house sitting for, et cetera. So how did that kind of, do you think, shape your sensibility as a young adult and maybe even a student as you moved on to schooling, including vet school and beyond, I guess?
Yeah, I think I was very fortunate to have various people in my life who were questioning things and the way things are going. And I was very open-minded to these things and open-minded to trying to live in a way that aligned with my values and aligned with protecting animals. So like that vegan meat teacher says that it takes 100 clicks for people to go vegan. So I've had like all of these experiences growing up, interacting with various people that have shaped who I am today. But yeah, like even in vet school, I was vegetarian and about a quarter of our class was vegetarian. But still there were classes in vet school where you had to kill animals or participate in dissecting animals that were sourced unethically, killed, and I decided not to participate in those classes that involved animal killing. These were mostly large animal surgery classes that involved killing cows and pigs, and I just didn't participate in that. I went to school at UC Davis, and UC Davis is known as one of the more progressive veterinary schools, and it's the best veterinary school in the world. But they still, to this day, have those classes where animals are needlessly killed for students to learn surgical training on. And so I want to do more to try to change veterinary schools and have them transition away from those practices.
And Dr. Heath, when people like yourself opt out of those classes, does that put any of their education or grades or anything in jeopardy?
In some cases, yes, we have heard horrible stories of students being retaliated against for being conscientious objectors to animal harm in veterinary schools. One student who wrote a blog for us on our website talks about she had to accept an F, a failing grade, because she refused to participate in a lab that involved basically cutting up this bull and then killing him afterwards. And she was made fun of by her classmates and scolded and all of these things. And so it's a real problem. Students are scared and they're worried that they won't get the necessary surgical experience that they need to become good veterinarians. And that's really troubling when you are just sort of normalized to animal harm in veterinary school. So we're working to change that. There are many schools doing things the right way or trying to, but there's still a lot of room for improvement there. And we just published a paper in the Journal of Veterinary Medical Education, which looks at all of the protocols for all of the schools and how many animals are killed and how the animals are sourced for student education. And we discovered of the public veterinary schools that we looked at, most are still have these protocols where animals are killed for student training or animals are sourced in unethical ways. For example, animals are purchased from pet stores or they're purposely bred by biomedical supply companies for students to kill them in their training. And this is really troubling, and it harms the reputation of the veterinary profession. Are we really caring advocates for animals, or are we stuck in outdated practices that don't need to exist anymore?
And so in that paper, how did your old alma mater fare? I mean, are they like catching up and sort of going even ahead of the curve, or where do they stand?
No, they're still somewhat in the middle, because they still do kill calves and pigs. The students are asked to do hernia repairs on these pigs, and then the pigs are just killed afterwards when the pigs could be woken up and the students could get the opportunity to see how they recover from surgery, and these pigs could go to a sanctuary. But they kill them because they say, oh, the pigs are given these drugs that would make their, that would not pass for them to be slaughtered for food. So we're just going to kill them instead of waking them up and sending them to slaughter. Like, they have no other option other than waking them up and sending them to slaughter or just killing them. When there is another option, it's sending them to a sanctuary, letting them be adopted out. Or even just practicing on pigs who actually need that hernia repair and letting them live their lives. So, yeah, it's really concerning. But my goal is within the next 5 years, all of these schools will end the killing of animals for veterinary education.
Well, that sounds like a noble objective, or especially with kind of what you're, I mean, because what you're up to, against, and you find this so much across so much of the animal world, unfortunately, is basically can be reduced down, and we've always done it this way. And yeah. That sounds like what medical schools, UC Davis, and, you know, sadly many others, that sounds like that's what's propelling this and making it kind of resistant to change in the way that you guys are, sounds like, advocating for.
Yeah, absolutely. And medicine is a scientific endeavor, so we should seek to constantly improve things. And human medical schools, they have abolished the use of animals in their training altogether. And veterinary medicine needs to catch up. If human doctors can be trained without harming animals or humans, then absolutely veterinary schools can do the same thing. And that's, we've got to practice that evolution and that growth and that following evidence-based research and more ethical practices. That is what medicine should be founded upon. But because these are institutions and there's this institutional inertia, it's hard to change these protocols. There's this bureaucracy in place that's very slow moving, and it just takes a lot less effort to keep the old curriculum the way it was than it is to change their curriculum. And so we tend to just rely on that. And a lot of people think, well, if since I had to do these unethical practices, then it must have been important. And so they justify it to themselves. And I've heard a lot of excuses like, well, if you eat bacon, then you shouldn't be complaining about the killing of animals in veterinary school for student training. And it's like, those are two completely separate issues.
Yeah.
You could still believe that you need animal protein to be healthy, which we know isn't true, and we can have that discussion. But you can also believe that you can train students without killing animals. You know, those are two separate things. Just because we kill animals for protein production does not mean we need to kill animals for student education.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm thinking about this, too, as you're talking here. It seems like problematic and ironic and other, you know, things too at odds that med school, like human med school, has evolved away from using animals in as part of its curriculum, and yet a vet school still sounds like in many cases predominantly, I guess, even clings to the use of that, which just seems highly backwards, just on the face of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people end up, you know, deciding, what do I want to go into, vet school or medical school? And I think a lot of people choose med school because they have compassion for animals. They don't want to see animals suffering. They don't want to see animals being killed. They don't want to have to euthanize animals. So they choose medical school. So in a lot of ways, medical school students have more progressive views about animals than veterinary school students. And right now, veterinary schools are selecting for students from rural areas to meet the demand for veterinarians in animal-based protein production. Mm-hmm. There's this huge shortage of rural veterinarians to serve these corporations that exploit animals for protein production. And so they're especially selecting for men because women are more likely to have a problem with this.
Wow.
These practices. We care more about welfare. So even though 80% or so of incoming vet students are women, and a lot of the applicants are women, they're like struggling with like, how do we get more men into this? Because men are going to be more likely to kind of go along with the corporate interests and do this. So this is a real struggle too. And it's interesting, only about 7% of veterinarians work in animal-based protein production. The vast majority of veterinarians, more than 70%, are small animal companion veterinarians. So we care about farm animal issues, but we've been kind of told, stay in your lane, you don't understand the issues, don't criticize your colleagues working in animal-based protein production. So those who are working in these systems, those working for animal-based protein production, are of a certain mindset, and they kind of go with the flow. And so this has led to the rise of gestation crates where sows are kept in these 2.5-foot by 7-foot gestation stalls for 114 days of their pregnancy, the rise of pig slaughterhouse gas chambers, and the use of ventilation shutdown to kill animals en masse during emergencies and infectious disease outbreaks. This is where they seal up barns, pump in heat and steam, and wait for the animals inside to die after many hours as an emergency to mass kill these animals, which are, these are all horrifying practices that never existed until fairly recently. And veterinarians have been the ones to allow and condone these absolutely atrocious practices.
Wow. Well, let me let folks know who might have just be tuning in a bit late. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Schultz. If you did just tune in, my guest is Dr. Crystal Heath, a veterinarian who holds views that often run counter to those that characterize traditional veterinary medicine, and of course, as we're also hearing, veterinary medicine education. Towards that end, she's also the executive director of our Honor, nonprofit supporting veterinary professionals and promoting ethical practices. And she'll also be a speaker at the 2025 Tampa Bay Veg Fest, November 8th at Perry Harvey Senior Park. If you'd like to ask Dr. Heath a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. Actually, we'll take a call right now.
Oh, cool.
Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Heath.
Yes, hello.
Hi, go ahead, please. Did you have a question or a comment for Dr. Heath?
Well, a comment, you know, and this is a fantastic program you have going on and very informative. I wanted to say, and I can't mention any names where I used to work, but I worked for pharmaceutical companies in the past in clinical research. And it was disturbing to me all the time about how unnecessary experiments were conducted on animals when a lot of this information was readily available in computer modules. So I just really wanted to say, with AI, and it is a distinct possibility now, that that could be an obsolete learning tool to experiment on animals and then euthanize them. It's barbaric. However, I just wanted to throw that out there. And, you know, thanks a lot for, you know, everything you're doing. It's fantastic.
Well, thanks for your call. Do you have a response to that, Dr. Heath?
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. We have a lot of veterinarians who formerly worked or currently work in lab animal research, and they talk about the bullying and retaliation that they face when voicing concerns about their research labs. And this is very concerning. Even a former veterinarian who used to work for that, is it South Carolina lab where 40 monkeys escaped, before that whole happened, I don't know if you heard that story, 40 monkeys escaped from this lab fairly recently, and there was also a problem with the climate control. This person reached out to us and said, this is a huge problem with this lab. Their cages don't work. Their staff is poor. I'm forced to do these experiments and surgeries on these primates for testing various drugs, but their livers are all cirrhosed from previous experiments that have been done on them. How are we getting any good data off of these primates? This is absolutely horrifying. But it's so disturbing. It's almost a cult-like indoctrination that some of these lab animal vets get. And there's these thought-stopping cliches of, like, this work saves lives and we are advancing medicine, when really the data doesn't show that. We learn a lot more based doing just observational clinical research on the species that is appropriate for that. And I'm thankful that now a lot of animal experimentation is being defunded right now. But I think we also we need to reprioritize the way that we invest in scientific research towards more observational epidemiological research, providing access to care. Yeah, we're spending millions developing these new drugs that nobody can afford and nobody has access to. So if we instead just funded diagnostics and treatment for animals who needed it, what might we find? What might we discover? So many animals go through life not having access to lab tests, CT scans, MRIs, and just basic PCR panels to discover what sort of viruses they're harboring. And I think we would find out so much more about how our world works if we provided that access to the animals that we love and care about and the humans we love and care about too. So that's kind of my vision for the future, is expanding access to care and publicly funded healthcare for everyone, no matter their species, and then making everybody part of this endeavor to discover more about the diseases that are out there and what cures we could discover in an ethical way that doesn't involve harming others in order to get cures that would only benefit those in power.
I'm in full agreement. I think that it's computer modules and anything yeah. that advances, you know, animal welfare and you know, making sure that we are absolutely ethical and this is the way to go. So AI could very well, in this case, very much be a real wonderful tool. So,
well, thanks so much for your call and your comment on that and your input. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Wonderful show. I love it.
Thanks so much. Thank appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. So, Dr. Heath, you're obviously a practicing veterinarian, dividing your time, as I understand it, at least between caring for animals at a shelter and at a veterinary practice. First of all, what kind of shelter do you work at? Is it municipal or county, or what type of shelter are we?
Right now I just kind of do relief work for a bunch of different shelters.
Oh, okay.
From municipal shelters, like where they have to take in everyone, to selective intake shelters where they pick and choose animals. So I've worked in both, but right now I'm primarily do high quality, high volume spay neuter because I feel like that is the most important work. We will reduce shelter intakes if we spay and neuter more animals. And I think that's where I want to focus my efforts and getting that sort of care publicly funded. I think we need publicly funded spay neuter. Everybody should get a spay neuter for free and publicly funded vaccines and parasite treatment.
Oh, you beautiful dreamer, you.
Yeah, we would solve the vast majority of problems. I mean, Americans spend $38 billion a year on healthcare for their companion animals, but we're spending $24 billion a year on animal experimentation, and $38 billion a year is going to subsidize animal-based protein production. So literally, we could fund veterinary care for every animal in the United States if we redirected those public funds to support that. And I think that would lead to a much better outcome for humans and animals if we did that.
So if I understand it, your primary shelter work is really focused on spay-neuter procedures.
Yeah.
If I understood this, you sort of balance that out with working at a veterinary practice of some kind. What kind of practice is that?
Right now, I do not work at like any sort of general practice, veterinary practice.
Oh, okay.
I mostly just do shelter work, spay neuter work for nonprofits. So I used to work in general practice, and honestly, it's horrifying because the cost of veterinary care is so high right now. So many people can't afford it. And a lot of vets end up having to euthanize animals who they could save because their humans just can't afford the cost of veterinary care. And it's just awful. And these practices, general practices, are usually very inefficient. And you're not helping that many animals in a day because you're spending so much time talking to their owners. I did work at an access to care clinic that was a for-profit clinic where we did a lot of vaccines and preventative medicine, which I found very rewarding. But your mainstream general practice, especially if it's been bought out by private equity, and now they are cost, they're it costs so much. It's really a depressing place to work. And I hope we can find a way out of that, because many people are leaving the field because it's just so depressing and there's so much compassion fatigue in these places. But it's also harming the way we treat animals. So, yeah.
Yeah, and not unrelated to those things. There's been more than a few articles, stories, other pieces about the disproportionate suicide rate amongst veterinarians as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of vets are hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, and they feel like, oh my gosh, I graduated vet school. I work in a general practice, and I hate it. I hate going to work every day and having to kill animals instead of help them. And they don't see a way out. They don't see a way out of their debt, and they hate going to work, and they ultimately make that hard choice, which we shouldn't put people in that position. These are really thoughtful, caring people that we're losing due to just end-stage capitalism and the product status of our patients. So we have to find a way out of this as fast as we can.
And this may bring us to Our Honor. Can you sort of describe, if you could, what Our Honor is and what it seeks to do, what its mission is?
Yeah, so Our Honor is a nonprofit veterinary advocacy organization, and we support and empower veterinarians, veterinary students, and animal professionals to work for the best interests of others, no matter their species. So a lot of us face bullying and retaliation for voicing concerns about AVMA policies, our workplace policies, our school policies, and we felt the need to join together and empower each other and fight for change. You often feel, if you're like that one student who's a conscientious objector to animal use at your vet school, you feel like you're all alone. But now Our Honor shows these people that there's a lot of us. And I think the vast majority of veterinarians believe, like we do, that we should not harm animals needlessly. And they just weren't given hope. They're like, oh, I used to think this is the way the world is. I got to deal with it. And didn't see a way out, didn't see how these things can change. And so we are mobilizing the veterinary profession to join together, identify the problems, and change these things. And we do a lot of work supporting animal advocacy campaigns. Historically, vegans and animal rights activists are viewed as not trustworthy. They're just doctoring footage to raise money for their organizations. And we lend veterinarians to give legitimacy to these campaigns and say, like, no, footage is actually true. This is a problem. And so we help support the animal rights movement that way by lending veterinary voices to these causes, too.
Again, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Stress. I'm speaking with Dr. Crystal Heath, a veterinarian and executive director of Our Honor, which we just heard about, a nonprofit supporting veterinary professionals and promoting ethical practices. Dr. Heath will also be a speaker at the 2025 Tampa Bay Veg Fest, November 8th at Perry Harbor Senior Park. If you'd like to ask Dr. Heath a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at WNF.org, or text 813-433-0885. So, Dr. Heath, if someone described you as a whistleblower, how would you react to that characterization, and what would they be referring to?
I guess that's correct. So I think they're referring to the fact that I raised concerns about the American Veterinary Medical Association policies, one of the biggest ones being condoning ventilation shutdown. This is a method of mass killing farmed animals where they seal up buildings, pump in heat, and wait for the animals inside to die. Because the American Veterinary Medical Association allows this, that means that these corporations that do this get millions of dollars in taxpayer-funded bailouts when they kill their animals this way in response to emergencies. And so I raised awareness about this, joined together with other vets. As a result, I've been barred from attending AVMA conferences like the Cargill-sponsored Humane Ending Symposium. The AVMA has characterized me as somebody who would make it an unsafe space just for my presence, even though I'm fairly professional and soft-spoken usually. They kind of characterized me as a dangerous person in one media report, which is highly concerning. So I'm raising awareness about the corporate capture of the AVMA. I'm raising awareness about terminal labs and veterinary schools. That's another way I've become somewhat of a whistleblower into these veterinary practices. But I think all veterinarians should be a whistleblower about these things in some way. So I hope to empower more whistleblowers.
So I'd be curious to know, in light of some of the issues you've raised and concerns that you've raised, and that you've done a lot of work and considered a dangerous person in some regards, which somehow makes me laugh. I'm not sure why. but given all those things, what would be your one or two favorite things about being a veterinarian currently? Because it sounds like you're up against a lot. There's a lot of things that concern you. But what do you love most about it now? You've been, obviously, as we've established, a lifelong animal lover from the time you were a kid. And here you are as a veterinarian, and you're up against various industry and other elements that are troubling to you. So what do you love most?
I love being a veterinarian. I highly recommend it. I want to encourage more people to be it. From the hands-on side, I love the directly caring for animals and making their lives better, like on the individual level. But I also love that my title gives me some legitimacy to speak about animal issues to the stakeholders that matter, to the politicians who listen to me because I'm an expert. I love that I have that power, and I love the fact that I can help animals individually and in a systemic way, too.
Okay, cool. We're sort of nearing the end of our time, Dr. Heath. As I mentioned a couple times, you'll be a speaker at the Tampa Bay Veg Fest coming up on November 8th. And delivering a talk called Bridging the Divide Between Activists and Veterinarians. Now, I certainly don't want to get into spoiler territory, but I'd love it if you could give us maybe a bit of a sneak preview. First, can you kind of describe how you see this divide?
Yeah, I think there's, on one hand, veterinarians have been very suspicious of animal activists because we have been attacked by animal activists. Activists have attacked some shelters that I work for because they don't understand why we are put in this horrible position of having to euthanize all of these unwanted animals. And activists have attacked veterinarians working in laboratories. And yes, we are participating in a lot of harms. But I think there's also the need for activists to understand more what veterinarians go through and what are ways that activists can help break veterinarians out of this cult that they have been indoctrinated into. So I'll talk a little bit about that, how activists can approach veterinarians, and also tell them what I'm doing to get the veterinary profession to engage more with activists to help support their campaigns, and so we can all work together to make a better world for animals.
Yeah, I think listening to you in this conversation here, I mean, you're already, I think you would acknowledge, something of an activist yourself while also being a veterinarian at the same time. So in a way, you kind of bridge the divide in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's challenging. I have been attacked, retaliated against, bullied by various animal advocacy groups for voicing concerns internally about some of their practices. And it has cost me speaking engagements. It's cost me funding. But I think, you know, that's just a sign that I'm doing things right, and I'm willing to stick my neck out there and say what I believe. And I think more people should be empowered to say the hard thing, even if it's going to give you some backlash temporarily. Ultimately, it's worth it if you're living in alignment with your values and speaking in alignment with your values.
For sure. Now, I think you live in practice in California, correct?
Yeah, Los Angeles.
Okay. So I think it's probably notable, on a somewhat related note, to mention that less than 2 weeks ago in California, where you are, the state banned cat declawing statewide. Yeah. So I'm going to guess that's been a concern of yours in the veterinary practices that offered that, and We've done numerous shows about the sort of the horrific declaw procedure. Off of speaking with Dr. Jennifer Conrad of the Paw Project.
Well, awesome.
So that statewide ban really represents progress. I mean, a few other states have already implemented such bans, and hopefully others will follow suit. But is there something else that's like an issue kind of in the way of declaw that you think is a top priority for people to focus on addressing or trying to get some legislation passed about?
Oh, gosh. What is the biggest one? There's a lot of balls in the air. And, yeah, we definitely have supported the declaw ban, much to the chagrin of the California Veterinary Medical Association, who's been campaigning against it. But what is the big thing? I think, you know, the bailouts for bird flu. Bird flu is a big issue right now. And we're talking the dairy cows infected with bird flu have 1 billion virus particles per milliliter of milk. This, like, threatens our food security and public health. And if there's some way to end subsidies for these industries, for bailing them out for bird flu, I would be all for that. Easier things might be ending ear cropping, ending tail docking, stuff like that. But, you know, the biggest issue, I think, is the subsidies that go to animal-based protein production that just threatens our public health and our food security.
All right. Well, we might just leave it right about there. So
cool.
We've been speaking again with Dr. Crystal Heath, and different websites you could check out to find more information about her or some of the organizations she's involved with include ourhonor.org. And again, she'll be at Tampa Bay Veg Fest coming up on November 8th at Perry Harbor Senior Park giving a talk. I think 1 o'clock is their scheduled time. So, Dr. Heath, thank you so much for making the time to join us on Talk Animals, and we'll look forward to seeing you on November 8th at Veg Fest.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Absolutely. Had a lot of fun.
All right, cool. Thanks so much. In a moment, I'll speak with Leah Beery, Tampa Bay Baywatch Discovery Center, about Boo on the Bay, the event involving critters, science, and fun happening this Saturday, October 18th. We'll hear more about that event and the Discovery Center in a moment on Talk Animals. Right now, time to step into the Comedy Corner with a piece from a longtime Talk Animals fave, Brian Regan, selected with Dr. Heath's interview in mind in a way. This is piece is called Doctors and Veterinarians here on Talk Animals on WNF.
My doctor looked at me and said, Brian, you are way too sedentary. So I vowed in that moment to get a dictionary. But I haven't gotten around to it, you know, just been laying around a house. Or is it lying around a house? Doctors specialize, right? Last month I went to an ear, nose, and throat doctor. Last week, I went to an arch of the foot, small of the back, nape of the neck doctor. I have fallen arches, my small's too big, and I have a trick nape. It's weird. In the human world, there's a doctor for every body part, but in the animal world, a veterinarian takes care of all animals and all their parts? It's gotta be the hardest job in the world. Where are the bighorn sheep knee doctors? The wildebeest gastroenterologists. The giraffe throat, and throat doctors.
That was Brian Regan, today's Comedy Corner. For the piece called Doctors and Veterinarians, taken from his Netflix special, On the Rocks. Now it's time to speak with Leah Beery of Tampa Bay Watch Discovery Center about Saturday's event, Boo on the Bay. So let's hear more about both things by welcoming Leah Beery to Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Leah.
Hi, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. So first, maybe let's get started with briefly asking you to describe Tampa Bay Watch Discovery Center.
Sure. So Tampa Bay Watch is an environmental nonprofit. We've been working to improve the quality and health of the Tampa Bay watershed for more than 30 years in various ways through restoration projects and education and outreach. And the Discovery Center is our newer facility on the St. Pete Pier. We opened in 2020 and it's a public facility, nature center, where anyone can come visit us and explore our exhibit gallery, participate in boat tours and public programs to learn all about Tampa Bay, the work Tampa Bay Watch is doing to restore it and protect it, and learn how they can help.
Well, that sounds really cool. How often do you guys hold events there?
We hold events fairly often throughout the year, but we're moving into the holiday season, and that makes our event schedule even fuller. We have lots of exciting things coming up.
Cool. And a lot of them geared chiefly for kids, or not necessarily?
A lot of them are targeted for kids, but they're all available to all ages. Anyone can come and have fun. Everything's family friendly. And we try to offer something for everyone. If you'd like to learn about Tampa Bay, then we have a program or an event that you might like to join.
Very cool. Well, I think that brings us now to the main event, at least for today's conversation, Boo on the Bay. So first, it's happening this Saturday, October 18th at 11 a.m., I believe. And
yeah.
That's at the at the Discovery Center itself, correct?
It is. Boo on the Bay is coming up this Saturday. It's from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. And it is at the Discovery Center, but we are actually hosting it out front on our, we call it our floating classroom, but we have a deck above the water out in front of our building, and there will be all kinds of fun activities set up out there for people to enjoy, including some arts and crafts, some pumpkin decorating, some animal encounters, photo ops, all kinds of really fun stuff for families.
So when you say animal encounters, what would be more specific examples? That's right up our alley here at Talking Animals, of course.
Well, we have an animal collection of animal ambassadors at the Discovery Center, which are animals that we keep under our care to help educate people about both native and invasive species. And when we host events, we like to bring some of them out to make an appearance and meet some of our guests. So I'm not going to tell you exactly which animals we'll be bringing out, but people who come out to the event can expect to meet and maybe have a photo taken with some of the animals throughout the day.
Wow. Well, that sounds tantalizing the way you put it. And it starts at 11, but how long does the day run, Leah?
The event ends at 3 p.m.
Nice. So it's 11 to 3?
Yeah. And there's also a lot of fall festivities going on the pier that day outside of the Discovery Center. So it's a really good weekend to come out and enjoy.
Very cool. So how do we, if we're interested in participating, do we sign up? Do we register? Do we get tickets? What's the next step?
You are welcome to purchase tickets on our website, which is pbwdiscoverycenter.org, or you can just show up and buy tickets on the spot. We don't expect them to sell out. We've got plenty of space. So just come on down to the pier and buy your tickets at the Discovery Center. And if you attend Boo on the Bay, it's $10 per person, but that also includes admission to the center, so you can come in and check out the exhibits after.
Cool. Well, this sounds like a great day in the making for sure. So,
yeah, it's going to be really fun.
Awesome. All right, well, Leah, well, thanks so much for coming on the show, and I know you had to duck out of a seminar to do so, so I appreciate it all the more, but it's great to hear about Boo on the Bay and a little bit more about the Discovery Center overall. So thanks for joining us today, and good luck on the event Saturday with Boo on the Bay.
Thank you so much. Hope to see some people out there who love animals.
I'm sure you will. Thanks so much.
All right.
Take care now.
Have a great day.
You
Bye.
Too. Bye-bye. Coming up on WNF, it's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, it's The Scoop, WNF's brief news recap. Then we shift back to music programming with Sam Vall, holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C, hosting the Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m., then Alley with Sound Safari, followed by Step Outside from 8 to 10, and more, just so much great music happening here on WNF here at 88.5. And we just concluded, as you probably know, a week of fundraising. So if you didn't get a chance to make a donation, you're invited, of course, to go to WNF.org and make a donation. You can earmark it for any shows that you like or that you might have missed a chance to donate for and support. And we'd love to hear from you at WNF.org on that. Meanwhile, on this show at the moment, as a prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering something from the Talking Animals Vault. We have all kinds of trinkets and goodies there. The first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song, I'll probably give it largely away by saying, meant to play this a couple of weeks ago when we did this show regarding walruses. So this is Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals on WMNF. Folks, Heather Brady knew that it was, of course, I Am the Walrus by the Beatles. So that means we just reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. My guest next Wednesday, October 22nd, will be Andrea Gibbon, founder and president of Protecting Paws for Life, a Florida-based nonprofit dedicated to helping domestic violence shelters become and remain pet-friendly. A timely interview noting that October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And one of the central elements of domestic violence shelters is most of them, unfortunately, still do not allow pets. So it further complicates the situation for survivors who are often reluctant to leave their home without being able to bring their animals. So that's all next Wednesday here on Talking Animals on WNF. So we'll catch up with you. Stay tuned for the conversation right after NPR News. And it's The Scoop. And we'll see you next week. 11 a.m. here on Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachi, and beyond. Stay tuned for the conversation and more here on WNF. Thanks. Thanks again for your donation and support for all our shows.